swung up my shield suit, and my heart opened the hatch to open the back door and stepped into the surface of the alien world. The gigantic
us now is Larry Mullins, not the guy from U2. This guy, better known by the name Toby Dammit. He famously, as a teenager, drove around the country following Iggy Pop on tour with his drum kit in the car. He would set up in the parking lot hoping Iggy Pop would hear him play and invite him to play with him. And guess what? It worked. I've seen Larry Mullins perform as Toby Dammit, or Larry Mullins, with Iggy Pop and Reformed Stooges about 10 years ago, I guess. I've also seen him as a member of The Residents. God, that was probably 20 years ago. Jesus, 20 plus. Warsaw, I think it was. Anyway, this is his brand new, well, no, out last year solo record, Chemisonia. The song is called Hotel Crescent. Well, I better hurry up here. Ginny and the Galleons doing the Third Man theme. Thank you, Monica, for turning me on to that great, great Ace compilation called Intoxica, Strange and Sleazy Instrumental Sounds from the SoCal Suburbs, specifically Downey, California. Mall, before that, from 1997 Special Education, did the Flash Gordon story. Daughters of the Vine did Manifest. Oh, we heard Jessamine in there from their 1994 debut, Ordinary Sleep. Was the name of the song. The Duncan Trio, three people playing DX7s, my most despised synthesizer, sounding great here on NOLA, version of NOLA. The Great FI from 1987 did Meridian Channel, from the record of the same name. John M. Bennett accompanied them with some of his poetry from Blanksmanship. Clotilda, before that, from last year, the track was Heartwood. Sun Fear, also from last year, a track called Steps. We heard a brand new one from William Tyler. It's called Time Indefinite. The track was called Star of Hope. Elijah McLaughlin and Caleb Willits, a track called Vesper. And top of that very long set, the collaboration that had to happen, Natural Information Society and Bitchin' Bajas, the new thing on Drag City called Totality. We heard Clock. No Clock. My name is Scott. I look forward to seeing you next week, friends, right here on Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide, online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Mark Hurst, Tectonic, is next. Bye. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Thanks so much for choosing to join me. Got a great show for you today. I'm featuring an interview with Sybil Darable. He is the author of a new book called The Infrastructure Book, How Cities Work and Power Our Lives. And as the title suggests, good title for a book about infrastructure, The Infrastructure Book is talking about the key underlying technologies that power our day-to-day lives. Could be water, electricity, waste management, all sorts of things that go into making cities work. The book is really focused on cities, although there's, of course, infrastructure outside of cities. The case studies in the book are focused on cities, as you'll hear in the interview. And as we go into this, I just want you to think, when was the last time when you turned on the tap to get some water from the sink, when was the last time you thought about where that water comes from? Has that ever come to mind? I mean, you turn the handle, the water comes out if all is working well, and that's great. And it's easy to take for granted. We don't often think, well, what is the actual water source that is providing this water? Of course, it's coming through pipes, you know that, but where does it originate? And maybe how is it treated along the way? We just, in this modern society, we have a lot of technologies that are life-saving, life-giving, life-providing that we don't know a whole lot about. And this book helps to correct that. And it's also, I was enthusiastic about this book because these are all technologies that I think we can agree are good for everybody. I really could not find downsides to, you know, running water and having electricity provided to homes and schools and hospitals and that sort of thing. So as opposed to many of the shows I do where I am notifying you or warning you or even focusing on the downsides of some of the digital platforms that are out there, today the show is almost a celebration of a whole class of technology that is really good for all of us and is worthy of praise, and it's worth knowing more about. So I'm happy to feature Sybil Darable in this book. If you'd like to join in the live listener comments, you can go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. The playlist for today's show is on tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and just click the playlist link for the Sybil Darable show, and you'll see links to the book and other things. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Sybil Darable here on Tectonic. Sybil Darable, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. You've just come out with The Infrastructure Book, which takes readers on a tour of how cities around the world handle things like water treatment, sewers, public transportation, energy, and telecommunications. These are obviously important topics, but most people don't think about infrastructure or, in some cases, even know how it works.
Absolutely. That's why I wrote the book. So a lot of my work deals with the future of infrastructure. In particular, we might talk about in the future, but in the after. But there's a lot of interdependencies between infrastructure systems. There's a lot of ways that we can be doing things better. But I realized that most people do not even know how infrastructure works, you know, right now. And so this book is sort of a primer just to tell people again how it works very in a very simple and engaging way.
Okay, let's describe how you've designed this book. Each chapter covers how one particular city handles a type of infrastructure. So, for example, we learn about the sewers in Paris and the electricity grid in Chicago. And then each chapter ends with a short case study. Actually, that's from another city. So there's really two cities, at least, in each chapter. And the case study covers an infrastructure project in that city. All told, I think the book covers, is it 31 cities or more than that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I just tell people 16 because it's the 16 major cities. But you're right. There's at least one at the end, sometimes two. In one case, there's two. And then the very, or before the last chapter, then we go into space. So it's not a city. But the goal for me was to, so infrastructure, engineering can be dry. And so I really wanted to have a book that was a bit more engaging for the public, so they would like it. And so I had this idea of picking cities. And so one infrastructure system, at least one city. And in most cities I've been to, and so the way, again, it's written is there's a bit of me traveling in the city. There's the engineering principles about how the infrastructure of that city works. And then I go back about some, you know, funky or interesting piece of information about that city, just to make it more engaging.
And we should say you work in this area. You're a professor of urban engineering at the University of Illinois, Chicago. So this book is for the lay reader, but it's also something that hopefully your students are going to be reading.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So when I wrote the book, I had really two markets in mind. So two audiences in mind. One was everyone, even people who don't like engineering, they don't like math, there's no equations, nothing, so that they can read it and they would enjoy it. And that includes students. And believe me, 18-year-olds don't read that many books. And so I really wanted to make sure that it was engaging, exciting, so they would actually enjoy it. And so I used the book in one of my classes. We go through one chapter every week. And the students really like it. And I'm really, you know, happy about that. The second audience I had in mind were professional engineers. Because the way that you're trained in engineering is that you quickly have to pick a specialty. So you have to pick just transportation, or just water, or just electrical engineering. And so most engineers now are experts in one, but they don't know anything about the others. And so they were the second audience, where they might skip over a few chapters, the ones that they know about, but they will learn a lot about the other chapters, and they will see how those other infrastructure systems overlap with their own infrastructure system. And I'm hoping it might make them maybe more creative and take a bit more risk to think about the future of infrastructure.
Yeah, I was impressed in the last couple of chapters when you start getting into digital technology that you went into detail in the TCP/IP stack, which some engineers will know all about, the transport layer and the application layer and those sorts of things. So you really do dive into the details, but not to an extent, like you said, there's no equations, at least in the main text. You do slip a couple into the footnotes, which I appreciated. But I found it to be a really helpful primer and a broad look at the engineering and the technology that underlies infrastructure. Why don't we dive into one of the examples? You cover one in the New York City area, which is the Catskill Aqueduct, which delivers water to the city from upstate New York. And this uses, as you write, the same principles as the Roman aqueducts. So, Sybil, what's the key to transporting water 150 kilometers from upstate New York down to Manhattan?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a great question. And it's probably a fundamental question, especially for New York, because supposedly you have the best tap water. I don't know. You have bagels that can't be replicated anywhere else in the world, or even, you know, pizza that's very special. But yeah, so the principle is actually fairly simple when you think about it. And we're all taught that when we were in school very, very early on. And I really want you to picture that one figure that you know about, where you have the ocean on one side, and right above the ocean, you have the sun, and the sun is hitting the ocean. So you have evaporation. And then on the other side of the picture, you have a mountain, and then you see clouds, and then it rains, and then the rain just, you know, goes down the mountain and all the way back to the ocean. And so really what we're talking about here is gravity. Water is not, you know, smart enough to defy gravity. It will, you just go from higher elevation to a lower elevation. So New York, by definition of, you know, New York is on the coast. So almost by definition, that's at a lower elevation. So the trick there was to find somewhere, you know, further away from New York at a higher elevation. So something more inland, like this Catskills. Where you had at least a difference in elevation, and then you just put a, you know, big pipe. And I say just as if it's not hard. It is hard, but the principle is you don't want to use pumps if you don't have to. So you put a pipe and you make sure you orient the pipe, you go through some areas so that you have sort of a constant slope, and so you can bring water wherever you want. And using gravity is something that we do all the time. And that is for drinking water, and that's in New York, but we use the same principle with sewers. So if you actually look at sewers, your wastewater treatment plant will always be usually closer to the ocean as well, or downstream of a river, because we use, again, gravity, just the slope, the natural slope of the land, to bring sewer wherever we want it to go.
Staying on the theme of water, I was fascinated with your description of desalination, which of course is turning salty seawater into drinking water. And this uses a process of reverse osmosis. Basically, if I'm getting this right, huge amounts of energy are used to push seawater through a filter with an incredibly fine mesh with holes just big enough to fit water molecules, but not salt or anything else.
Yep.
You write that, quote, "the final product is pure water, but while it is safe to drink, it lacks essential minerals that humans need that get stuck with the salt." That is, the salt molecules get stuck with other things in the filter. So the process of desalination, I was surprised. I didn't know this before I read this book. It actually requires a final step of putting some minerals back in the water.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you can see videos on that online. It's really a lot of rocks, a lot of limestone you put back in the water for the minerals. Because if you don't have minerals, minerals is what actually gets you to keep the water. If you just drink pure water, you just, you know, just go straight out and you're just going to pee it out. You need those minerals to be able to keep the water in you. So if you have too many minerals or too much of it, so if it's too salty, then you're going to retain a lot of water. But if it's not salty enough, or if you don't have enough minerals, you're not going to keep that water. But so the body is, you know, requires some minerals in a certain, you know, threshold as a minimum and maximum. And so that's why if you live in an area with a lot of desalination, in the book, it happens in Tel Aviv in Israel. So Israel is amazing with desalination. Another country amazing is Singapore. So if you get your water from that source, they remineralize it, but they remineralize it with limestone. It might not have everything. And so I always tell people, make sure you eat plenty of vegetables in those areas so that you get all the essential minerals that you need to be in good health.
In some stores, you can buy distilled water, which I assume is just water without any minerals. So if someone drinks distilled water, does that mean they could have problems?
Yeah, I mean, they're just not going to process the water. Something, I don't talk about that in the book, but something also that you might read is people who starve to death, they actually die of dehydration. It's because they just drink water. They don't eat anything, so they don't have minerals. And so in the end, they actually, all the water just leaves their body and they die of dehydration. So you need those essential minerals. And that's why the process of distillation, so what you do usually for that is you heat water, you boil it, then you have the water vapor, and then you get the pure water out of it. But you don't want that because you need those minerals. So that's why we prefer to find good water. You know, it might not be great, but it's good water. And then we remove the stuff that we don't want from it. And that's where we're going to use physical processes to screen stuff out, some chemical processes to get rid of some things that we don't want, especially the any dirt or something that's inside, and then you know, filtering as well. But you want those minerals. Without those minerals, you would not survive.
You have lots of interesting vocabulary in this book that I had never encountered before, that I guess is just for infrastructure engineers. Words like flocculation.
Yep, absolutely. Coag flocculation. It's a wonderful, absolutely wonderful chemical reaction. It's actually really fun, and I'm sure you've all seen it. You go to a lake, you go to a river, anywhere, you take a glass, you get a glass of water, and you'll see that it's going to be not transparent. There's going to be a little particles, and you're going to leave it there for a while, and you're going to see that some settle down, but it's always, you're always going to see some, you know, some turbidity, that's how it's called. It's never going to settle down perfectly. It's because those particles are negatively charged. So imagine you have a magnet, and they all have the same, you know, pole, and so two magnets on the same pole, when you put them together, they actually expel one another, and so that's constantly happening. So what we do is, first is the coagulation process. And so you neutralize those particles. So you make them not negative, just, no, they don't have a, they're neither they're negative nor positive. And then when that happens, they can start to form flocks. So this thing can start to clump together. And those clumps are heavy enough that they just settle in the bottom of a glass, of a basin, of, you know, everywhere. And so that's what we do in water treatment.
You also have several chapters on transportation, or transport, as you put it, both including highways for private cars and all the options for public transport like subways and buses. and also active transport, which is infrastructure for biking or walking. Here in the New York City area, transport has been a topic of some debate recently, given the start of congestion pricing, which charges fees for cars entering Midtown or downtown Manhattan. What do you think about cars in cities?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. That's a loaded question, because I don't have, I'm not for or against cars. Cars are absolutely amazing. They're essential. They've enabled us to do so many things that we weren't able to do before cars. The only problem with cars is that the amount of space that people take with cars is very high. And so if everyone wants to have a car and you have a dense area like New York City, you get congestion. And congestion is not good for anyone, right? It's not good for the economy. It's not good for health. It's not good for anyone. So that's where in some cities like New York City, you need to have more of a balance of modes. And that comes in different flavors. The best one is making sure that you don't even need a car in the first place because you can walk somewhere. Or even if you need a car, you can go just a mile out to get whatever you want instead of 10 miles. And that's called accessibility. And otherwise, if you need to go further, it's to have different options of modes, public transportation, biking is another good one. So I'm not against cars, but I think there's definitely a problem with the American car-centric culture. That's just not smart, because you're tied to one single mode. And if something happens to that one mode, then your entire life is disrupted. So that's one of the problems. In the book, also talk about the problem of greenhouse gas emissions, which is a completely different problem, very, very big. But I always say, even if all cars become electric, and even if that electricity comes from purely renewable sources, you still have congestion, and congestion is still not desirable.
In this book, you name your favorite infrastructure in the world. And interestingly enough, it's a project that starts with a crowded, elevated expressway. So it has to do with cars and congestion. This was set in Seoul, Korea. What was the problem that Seoul wanted to fix with that expressway? And what was the unusual solution that they came up with that yielded your favorite infrastructure in the world?
Absolutely. So I'll give you the context. Now, Korean War, 1950s. After that was peace. And then Korea really expanded, really boomed economically, population grew. And you needed to make way for the future. And in 1960s and 70s, the future was the expressway and more cars. So they found an area with a small stream and some houses that were not in the best conditions. And so they displaced everyone who lived there and decided to put a double-story elevated expressway. And they did that, again, because you had to make way for the future. And almost immediately that turned into a nightmare. You get congestion. So people, waste a lot of time in congestion. The air quality was bad. There were a lot of businesses that went around, but, didn't do that well, again, because of the air quality. The noise level was bad. It was just becoming a huge problem. And so in the 1990s, a mayor candidate ran on a very unusual platform, which is to remove it, just to remove it altogether. And you'd figure something, at least in the U.S., people would just be all up in arms against it. It's like, no, if you remove it, where's traffic going to go? But he was actually elected. They removed the expressway, and instead they restored the stream. But what I love about that is that the stream is below the level of the streets. And so now it's a wonderful linear park. If you go there, there's tons of trees, and it's beautiful, and it's amazing. But whenever it rains, you have, one person telling you to get out because they flood it. So they take all the water from the storms and the areas around and they flood the entire park, because it's better to flood that one park instead of flooding houses and all the buildings nearby. And it works extremely well. And then everyone, since I started this story, people are going to think, but what about traffic? What happened to traffic? It must have been a nightmare. And no, it didn't, for several reasons. One is people adapt. So they left earlier or they left later, or they maybe relocated somewhere else. A lot of people also decided to take transit instead, and Seoul has an amazing transit system. So no, it was not chaos. It actually went fine. And really, I really want to emphasize that people adapt. That's one of the things that I think engineers and policymakers forget, is that people do adapt to the conditions that they're given. And now if you go there now, the air quality is much better. The ambient air temperature in the summer is way lower, so it's nicer. There's also an incredible biodiversity, and all the businesses around are doing extremely well. So it's definitely a a strategy that I would recommend to cities in the US. And what I like to say about this particular case, and it's called the Cheonggyecheon River. And I always like to say that in the case of Seoul, a transport problem became a water solution. And I wish we had more of those unusual solutions in the world.
For Americans, hearing about that removal of the expressway, anyone in the Northeast might think about a project that you write about in that same chapter, which is the Big Dig in Boston, which, as I remember, I was in college in Boston around that time, and I think the project went over budget and it took longer than they expected, but they finally finished it, and the expressway, I think it was 93, they were putting underground. And now you can drive underneath the north end of Boston in a tunnel, and outside on street level, it's a park, as you said. What's the conclusion in the infrastructure community about the Big Dig? Is it considered to be a success?
Oh, that's a great question. We don't talk about it too much. What I thought about it is I remember when it also was built, and I remember when it was opened, and I remember being a huge fan. At the time, I was pursuing my studies at the University of Toronto in Toronto, Canada, where they have a very similar expressway. And I thought, wow, this is Boston is doing it right. We've got to be doing the same thing here. It's incredible. And then I learned about Seoul, and I thought, no, Seoul really got it right. Boston didn't get it right. Doing that project cost billions and billions of dollars. If all that money went into public transportation, chances are you didn't even need to do that project in the first place. And if you look now, that high expressway that's hidden in the tunnel is actually still congested, incredibly congested. And when they put it in the tunnel, they actually extended it, right? So it's an even bigger express than it used to be. It's still congested. And transit in Boston is good, but I really think it could be better. And if only that money was spent more on transit, I think the city would be better off right now. But that's my personal opinion. We don't talk about it in the infrastructure community much.
This book does have a very practical mindset. I mean, just speaking about how to deploy funds for infrastructure, this comes up in other chapters as well, where you're talking about cities that chose to build a small but very sleek and modern subway when they could have deployed the funds for a much broader, let's say, bus network that was not as expensive and would have served more people. So a lot of the time, it seems like infrastructure is just a question of how are we going to use whatever funds we have to serve the most number of people. It's a balancing act.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So that particular story that you mentioned is in Bogota, Colombia. And I like that story because Colombia is still, it's an incredible country. But Bogota had about 6 million people, I think, in 2000. Now they have over 11 million people. And they needed transport services. Before, they had unregulated buses, little vans picking up people, informal. Those vans would drive extremely fast just to try to pick up more riders, and was known as the penny war. It really didn't work well at all. And the mayor was elected at the time, was looking at solutions. And what I really like is anyone in his place would have argued for a metro system to be like New York or Tokyo or London, but he didn't. He was like, no, let's use that money. And instead of building one small metro line, let's have a huge bus rapid transit network. Bus rapid transit is when you close down a lane from traffic just for buses. And he did that. And now the system that's in Bogota is much bigger than most metro systems in the world. And so I like that story because it really took courage, I think, from the mayor to look at the resources that were available and do what was right for the people, as opposed to do, what was right from a branding or image point of view. And I always argue for that. And that's partly by why I also wrote that book, so that people know more about infrastructure in general, and so they can go and vote for the right person, or they can get elected themselves and pursue the right infrastructure projects for their own communities.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Sybil Darable. We're talking about his new book, The Infrastructure Book, How Cities Work and Power Our Lives. And in the first half of the interview, you heard several types of infrastructure. that Sybil covers in the book. And now we're going to listen to the second half of the interview and hear what other sorts of infrastructure we should be paying attention to. Again, if you want to go to the playlist, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the Sybil Darable episode. Here's the rest of the interview. In your chapter about Amsterdam, you write about shared spaces, which is where bikes and cars and pedestrians all together can safely use the same space. And I was interested to read that in order for drivers, bikers, and pedestrians to pay more attention, no markings are painted on roads.
Yep.
That seems counterintuitive, at least here in the States, where there are signs everywhere on the roads and the bike lanes and so on. How does that work so well without signs?
Well, without signs, you have to pay more attention. You have to go slower. You have to be more careful. And when you do, everyone is just better off. So as a pedestrian, you know, there's no sidewalks. You have to be careful, you know, if there's a car. So you're just more careful. If you bike, you have to be careful. If you drive a car, you have to be very careful. Often on the streets, they also have pavers instead of asphalt, so that it's even a bit more uncomfortable when you drive. And so you have to be careful. The person who came up with that, Hans Mannermann, a Dutch guy, he was a traffic safety specialist, an engineer. And one of the things he loved to do was to take the safety code. He would read it. He would go in the street, open the book like he's reading it, and then walk backwards in the middle of the street. And he did that on purpose to say, look, those drivers are not going to run me over. They see me. They're going to be careful. And I think that's an amazing story. And so removing those markings, not everywhere, right? Before some streets, you know, might make sense because everyone is more careful. So the shared space, I think, is a bit of an older concept now. We talk more about something called complete streets. And complete streets is, you know, kind of similar, where you do have some markings, but you make sure that you cater for everyone. And when you cater for everyone, for bikes, for cars, for pedestrians, then, you know, everyone is just better off. I'll tell you one thing, though. I've been in the U.S. now for 12 years, and I do think that a lot of people assume that people are dumb. Like, there's so many markings for everything. You know, it's everywhere. You have warnings and this and that, as if you just assume that everyone is dumb. And in my experience, people are not dumb. They're actually quite sensible. And so, yeah, sometimes if you remove markings, if you ask them to pay more attention, they will pay more attention.
I just wonder how that would work if a city tried that here in the U.S. because of a couple of things. One is our vehicles seem to be so much bigger than the ones you see in Europe. I mean, we have these giant SUVs and trucks, and I've seen the diagrams that show what the visibility is from the driver onto the street. With some of these SUVs, their grills are so high that they can't see, for example, kids, I don't know, 3 meters in front of the vehicle. It seems really dangerous. And then you combine that with the onset of phones and people driving while looking at a screen, which I see all the time in New York City. You just watch drivers as they go past, and a disturbingly high percentage of them are driving while looking straight at their surveillance phone. You put that together with streets that have no markings. I have to admit, Sybil, I would not, in the U.S., do that experiment of walking backwards while reading a book on a road that had no markings.
Really? But in New York City, I saw people crossing the street when, you know, they, you know, jaywalking everywhere. So if there's one place where you can do that is New York City. But I agree that the size of the vehicles is particularly large, and it is a problem. And I know I have a child. You know, she's 4 years old. She's extremely smart. She could probably, you know, easily walk across the street by herself and be fine. But just because the grills are so high, I don't even know when she'll be able to cross by herself. I mean, and she's asking me, like, what age can I cross by myself? I say, it's not about age. It's about height. When you're tall enough that the drivers can see you, then maybe you can, you know, cross by yourself.
If you ever write a second edition to the infrastructure book, I have a suggestion for an additional section in the transport chapters specifically about subways. The issue is about privacy and surveillance. You write in one of the chapters about smart cards for getting on public transport. And these are cards like the Ventra card in Chicago or the Oyster card in London. There are other cities that have them. Here in New York, the city is in the process of rolling out the Omni system, which is a smart card system for entry onto the subways and buses. And from all indications, and I've read a bunch of articles about this, it looks like Omni is capturing pretty intimate details about where people ride the subway and when, with the ability for the city to turn on and off their access to public transport. There was a story recently about someone's Omni card stopping working because of some small financial issue, like their credit card wasn't fully paid off, or it was something, and it was a matter of just a few dollars. And it was really difficult for this person to reactivate their Omni card. And that, I felt, was a red flag, because now we're seeing throughout the country the rise of an authoritarian surveillance state. And I wonder, shouldn't we be worried about smart card systems that allow the government, possibly an authoritarian government, to track and maybe even control how we use public transport?
I mean, obviously, yes. And what I like about what you just mentioned here is that you knowing more about infrastructure can enable you to have that concern. Say, this is a problem. And I think, you know, the smart card is one that's obvious because it's for transportation. But there's other things that you have in your house. You know, you have a smart meter data for electricity, for water. There's things that the company can do and things they cannot do. But you being informed and how it works can have a voice and can express how you would like things to work better. And so I don't have anything specifically about, you know, that issue of smart cards and privacy, but it's really in line with, you know, my personal mission, which is know about the infrastructure. And when you do, you can demand that it, you know, to be for it to be in specific way. But you can't create infrastructure if you don't know how it works, right? So that's why I, you know, again, that's partly why I wrote the book.
Now, on the other side of the spectrum, a place that is not an authoritarian surveillance state, as far as I can tell, you write about your own home island, which is, I learned by reading your book, a part of Europe, which is located in North America. Tell us a little bit about St. Pierre and Miquelon.
Absolutely. So it's a very small archipelago, a few islands, very, very, very few islands, off the coast of Newfoundland. So that's in eastern Canada. So it's not too far from Maine, not too far from Nova Scotia. It's right there in the middle of the ocean. So France used to have a lot of territory in Canada. It lost everything, but it kept those islands. And those islands still belong to France. And it's a French culture. People have Euro there, French citizenship. If you go to Canada, you need to have a special permit, even though it's 10 miles away from Canada. I mean, you can't see Canada from the island. So when I grew up, I would see Canada, except that when I went there, I had to use my passport. The voltage is 220 volts. You know, like Europe. So even when you want to recycle your appliances, you need to send them to Europe, not to Canada or the US, because it's a different voltage system. So I grew up there, and it's on an island of 5,000 people. So very, very small. And one of the things that's very apparent to everyone who lives there is where they get their water from, how, you know, the wastewater, where it goes, how the trash is handled, the electricity, you know, how it's generated, even telecommunication. And so, you know, everyone knows exactly where the water comes from. I mean, I would go on hikes just to look at the reservoir and come back. Same thing with the power station. So it's a diesel motors generating electricity. You know exactly where they are. You can go by. Same thing with the solid waste. So it's kind of a little bit further away. So you're not, you know, you're not affected too by it. Although they do burn a lot of the trash, and when the wind are not the right direction, it doesn't smell too good. And I think, you know, growing up on a small island, 5,000 people, that's not even using the same regulations as the island that's nearby, really made me more aware again of infrastructure systems. So made me more aware of it's not just transportation or just water or just electricity. It's all of it combined, all of it together. And that's how I can think now of the future of infrastructure in Chicago and New York. So even those gigantic cities, I can think of it as more, you know, interdependent, interconnected infrastructure.
I hope listeners are picking up on your sheer enthusiasm you have for infrastructure, because that came through in my reading of your book, the infrastructure book. Going through, I just said to myself, this guy loves infrastructure. And now I'm hearing the love started growing up in St. Pierre and Miquelon, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you, I'm a huge infrastructure nerd. I love it. My wife is in art history, you know, very, very far away from infrastructure. And everywhere I go, I have to take pictures of infrastructure and she's bored sometimes. I'm one of those annoying people whenever there's a hole in the street, you know, and there's workers. I got to go and ask them what they're doing. I got to say, oh, is that electricity? Is it gas? What are you doing? I got to ask them. I know my garbage truck driver. Now I go and talk to him to see how he's doing. I just love infrastructure. It's one of those things, you know, that you don't realize exists, but it's around you. And once you start to poke at it, it just swarms like, wow, there's this entire world that was really right there that I did not know about. And it's fascinating. So I'm hoping that, you know, through our conversation, I'm going to convince some people to join me in becoming an infrastructure nerd. But it is fascinating. And the one thing it is also is that it's absolutely accessible to everyone. You don't need to be an engineer to understand how infrastructure works. And yeah, so you know, join me on the infrastructure side.
You write at some point in the book that after you read this book, you are going to start noticing infrastructure in your daily life. And you know what? It's true. I finished the book and I started counting the lines on electricity poles and noticing other infrastructure on the street. And there's something else I wanted to bring up, that you write a couple of times about a good way to spot infrastructure, which is to look out of an airplane window, especially when you're taking off or landing. And I did that. I had a recent trip and I found myself looking out of the window and spotting things that look like infrastructure. What are some of the things we can see from an airplane that are infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's at least, well, beside the airport itself, right? That's infrastructure. There's at least two things that you'll often see. Sometimes you'll see ponds of water, so water bodies, but they're going to be oddly geometric. And that means that they're reservoirs, either stormwater reservoir. So if it's close to the airport, maybe there was a rain recently, and so they just, you know, dump all the rain there. Otherwise, it might be a drinking water reservoir. So you wouldn't drink directly out of it, but it could be an open reservoir that they then take the water to treat it and distribute it. That's one. I remember seeing that from London. I remember landing in London, seeing that, and as soon as I came out of the airplane, I took my phone, I looked at the map and said, yep, I was right. You know, that's a reservoir. And the other one is those large circular, again, water bodies. You know, and you see a bunch of circles, one, you know, next to one another. And those are called clarifiers, often primary clarifiers. And they're in wastewater treatment plants, so to treat your sewers. What's very interesting about them is why they're there and why you'll often see them next to airports. It's because as the city was created, usually a lot of the only available land was marshland, swamps. And so that was pretty much the area available for airports. You don't want to have an airport too close to people because of the noise, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's where you build your airport. But if it's also a swamp in the first place, it's because it's downstream of a river or it's at a low elevation, which means that it's by using gravity, your wastewater is going to go to a low elevation. So that's where you're going to have your wastewater treatment plant. So next time you look out and you see those, you know, look out the window and you see those circular, you know, basins, just tell yourself that it's a wastewater treatment plant. And it's funny, I told you before, I went to New York last week. And when I went there, then I caught a ride to go to my hotel. And when I did, we're driving and I saw huge egg-shaped, not buildings, but like egg-shaped structures in the distance. And I looked at them, I was like, yep, I know what that is. It must be a wastewater treatment plant, you know, not circular bodies, but egg-shaped. And what that is, it's an anaerobic digester. So you have your wastewater coming in, you separate the solids from the liquid, and all the solid, you have to do something with it. Sometimes you throw it directly in the landfill. Sometimes you put it in a big container without air. And then there's the microbes there start to digest all the organic matter in the sludge. And without air, you produce methane, so natural gas. You capture that natural gas, and then you use it for heating, for cooking, for whatever you want. And that's done in something called anaerobic digesters. And we don't really have those in the U.S. much, except in wastewater treatment plants. So if I don't know if you fly to New York, you might not see them. But if you ride in, and that was around Queens, you'll see them. Where I saw them as well was when I flew to Boston. So Logan Airport is right there by the sea. And also, that's also where you're going to see a wastewater treatment plant with those big egg-shaped structures. And again, these are those anaerobic digesters. And you know, sometimes I feel like a detective. I can look at a something in the city and say, oh, that's this infrastructure, which means that we're here, which means that this is happening, which means this. And I love that.
I'm smiling because I have never met anyone so enthusiastic about anaerobic digesters. And I feel like they've needed a fan, a champion for a long time, and now they have one.
Well, at least one. I'm sure there's many of us, or there should be many of us.
Well, you're making more. You're creating more in this book. There was one other aspect of this book I found very charming, and that was that you give local food picks in some of the cities that you're writing about visiting, such as the Andouillette in Lyon, or the Bak Kut Teh in the hawker centers of Singapore. And I guess you could do a whole companion book about eating your way through the cities you visited. How many cities did you go to while you were researching this book?
That's a great question. I should say, by the way, that I am a foodie because I think it's partly what it's a common ground between my wife and I, right? She's in art history, I'm in engineering. So there's at least architecture and food. You know, this is a common interest. So we always like to try, food, exotic food or wherever we go. I didn't really travel to many cities for that book in particular, but I've traveled to a lot of cities. And I always tell people, I grew up in an island of 5,000 people. So when I got out, I got out. So I have degrees from different countries, not only different universities, but different countries. And I've traveled quite a bit just because, again, I it was nice to see the world. And with my wife, we just like traveling. And that's what we do. And because I like food and because it's, one way to make writing a bit more engaging or fun, I do share some of my favorite dishes with readers in the book.
One other question I want to ask you, Sybil, is about technology. This show covers technology generally, both digital technology like social media, AI, and so on, but also the kinds of technology that you're writing about in the infrastructure book. How do you see the connection between what you're writing about in your book and the kinds of technology that maybe people are more aware of day to day?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Technology can be fantastic or it can be horrific. Somehow, I don't know why technology managed to get that image that whatever is coming out of Silicon Valley is good, whatever is new technology is good. It's not. If technology exists, it was made by humans, for humans. It should help us. It should make us happier. It should help us in our lifestyles. It should enable us to do things we're not supposed to or we could not before. And I don't think not all technology do that. So I like to say on there's sort of a spectrum where you have people who are techno saviors, and then you have on the other end, you have, let's say, people who are against technology. I'm not against technology, but I'm definitely more on that end just because I think it's being used, it's being applied as if it's going to solve all problems in the world, but it's not. And that's partly why, again, I wrote the book, understand how it works, and then go and make sure that your electric utility or your water utility is not hijacked by a technology company who are going to promise that they're going to make things more efficient by installing a bunch of sensors. It's not going to be the case. Those sensors are going to pick up data. They're going to collect, millions and millions of gigabytes of data. That's going to be very hard to interpret. It's not going to make things more efficient. The likelihood is it's actually going to make things worse and more, those structures are going to be more vulnerable. So you want to make sure that you use technology in the right way by making infrastructure more resilient and not by making it more vulnerable. So I love technology when it's applied properly, and being able to know when it's applied properly or not, that's challenging. And that you can't do that until you actually understand the infrastructure that's around you.
You finish the book with a couple of quotes, one from Patrick Geddes: "A city is more than a place in space. It is a drama in time." And then you've got a closing quote from the great Jane Jacobs, New York City's own, who wrote, "Cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they are created by everybody." And I think this book is a great step in encouraging more people to get involved in their infrastructure, if not to build it, at least to become aware of it. And I enjoyed it a lot and learned a lot. The book is The Infrastructure Book, How Cities Work and Power Our Lives, is published by Prometheus Books and written by you, Sybil Darable. Great job on the book, Sybil, and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It was a pleasure being here.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 10 plus minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Sybil Darable, author of the new book, The Infrastructure Book, How Cities Work and Power Our Lives. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, the interview. I think you can tell that Sybil has a lot of enthusiasm for all sorts of infrastructure, and the enthusiasm comes across as well in the book. And those case studies, as we talked about, they're all focused on one city at a time. So you get how Japan is actually using its waste treatment to make new land in Tokyo Bay, which is something I hadn't heard of. We learn about desalination in Tel Aviv. And you also visit Bogota and New York City and Singapore and on and on and on. So if you're interested in infrastructure and or cities, and you'd like to get some food tips along the way, check out Sybil's book, The Infrastructure Book. There's a link to the book on the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, that's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, click the playlist link for the Sybil Darable episode. This is a link to the book on a non-monopolistic online book platform. And I'd recommend it to you if you're interested in this topic at all. This conversation about infrastructure brings up a memory of mine from some years ago. Back in 2003, I was living in Manhattan. I mean, I've lived in Manhattan for, I don't know, almost 30 years, 20 something years. Anyway, I was living in Manhattan in 2003, as I still do, but in a different apartment. At the time, I was living in one of those high rise apartment buildings in Midtown, and the power went out. This was August 14, 2003, and anybody who lives in the New York area, if you've lived here long enough, you'll remember that day because it was a citywide blackout. And I remember climbing. I lived on a floor that was, I forget what number it was, 15 or 18 or something like that. It was pretty far up there. And of course, the elevators were out. So I climbed the stairs and I'm just dripping with sweat because it was a very hot day and obviously no air conditioning in the building. And I learned, once I got up there, that we had no water. I think we had, you know, one flush in the toilet was all we had because the water was there, but there was going to be no more water coming up. However, I learned during the blackout that water does go up to, I think it's the sixth floor, and this is something that Sybil Darable covers in the infrastructure book as well. Even when there's a blackout, there's enough water pressure to get the water up several floors. And so people who lived on lower floors had water, whereas on higher floors, like I was, we did not have water. But it was just interesting to feel the loss of that infrastructure, the electricity and the water that I had taken for granted. By the next morning, I was just, and look, New York acted really well during the blackout. There were outdoor barbecues. It was kind of a party, but I think everybody was really ready for the lights to come back on and the AC and the water, and it did that next day. But just in the space of, I mean, like just a few hours, I mean, not even 12 hours, I had some snacks, but I was hungry, and I just felt I need this electricity to come back on. And it really, just that brief outage, it lasted for about a day, made me really appreciate the basic service of electricity and water. And if you've ever been through a blackout, maybe you have a similar experience. So as Sybil said, it's important for us to become aware of the infrastructure that powers our lives. And it's important for us to participate in it somehow. Maybe just gaining awareness is enough. But some people may want to run for office or take a tour of the wastewater treatment plant or teach a local community group about what's happening. I mean, just get involved somehow. I really liked this quote that Sybil finished the book on, this Jane Jacobs quote, which I'll read again. Cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they are created by everybody. And I feel like Jane was reminding us that we all have a role in creating cities, which require infrastructure. And when there are players, let's say, that have power to participate and they opt out, that can create problems. And here, just to cut to the chase, I'm thinking of companies that do not pay their taxes that would otherwise go into funding things like better urban infrastructure. I remember years ago, I had Carolyn Chen on the show talking about her book, Work, Pray, Code. And we talked about how these companies, among other things, were not participating so much in the communities outside of their corporate walls. These are in the big tech companies in Silicon Valley. They would, for example, they would use their own private buses to bus people from San Francisco down to their campuses rather than encouraging people to use public transit. And an outcome of that is that since the companies were not paying taxes and they weren't asking their employees to participate in the public infrastructure that taxes would be paying for, they were like hermetically sealed kingdoms, and the public infrastructure at that time when Carolyn's book came out was really suffering in the Bay Area because the tax base was drying up because these giant companies were not paying taxes. And so going back to Jane Jacobs' quote, this only works if it's created by everybody. It's not just for everybody. It has to be created by everybody. And when you have the most powerful companies in the world, arguably in history, that are refusing to pay taxes, then our infrastructure that all of us rely on is vulnerable. And that becomes even more important as we go into this digital age. And there, this is something that Sybil did not get into in his book, but the rise of cybersecurity threats, because a lot of these pieces of infrastructure are online, and that leaves them vulnerable to hacks from malicious outside groups. There was a show I did a while back talking about Nicole Perlroth's book on cybersecurity. The book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. If you're interested, you should take a look. But there's a story from 2013, when there's a dam in upstate New York, just, I don't know, 20 miles north of New York City, and I think it's in Rybrook. And there was one day, people noticed that, I guess the team that manages the dam noticed that their digital systems at the dam that control the control whether the dam is up or down, the controls were acting strangely. The digital systems, something wasn't right with the digital systems. And it turns out that the dam had been hacked. And it turned out later, after some investigation, that it was Iranian hackers had taken over the dam. And if I remember right, I believe Perlroth talked about this in the book. But the analysis afterwards, whether it was Perlroth or someone else, was basically that the Iranian hackers were sending us a signal. We can take over this dam if we want. And so be on your guard. And so that's really the nightmare scenario, that we have all this infrastructure and it's not being properly maintained because our own big tech companies are not paying their taxes and there are militias actors outside that then are able to infiltrate our vulnerable systems because they're online and do damage to us. My point is that infrastructure matters, and it's going to continue to matter. And so conversations like this are really important, and they do tie into the digital technology that I cover in most other weeks. I hope you have found this helpful, friends. If you want more information, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H-tonic.fm. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Until I see you next time, friends, I do have a little bit of homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. We're going to go out to a new song by Adrian Carter called Squares. Have a good day, everybody, and I'll see you next time.
I was like, what? Are you playing at? And why is it so difficult? Carry on.
And good evening, friends. Welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. My name is Dave Mandel. I host this program. I'm here every Monday evening at this time, which is 7 p.m. Eastern time, 7 o'clock Jersey City time. Thanks for joining me this evening. Always excited to dive into another hour of this stuff. We're going to start tonight's show with some French music from a group called, well, they were originally called Art Moulu Très Fin, spoken in a hybrid French-English, French-American accent there, and later shortened their name to Art Moulu. And we're going to hear a track that they recorded for, so there was a label called Recommended Records, which was Chris Cutler's record label. And drummer Chris Cutler and sort of founder spearheaded the Rock in Opposition group, and he had a label called Recommended Records. Recommended later morphed into Ray Records, or however you want to pronounce it, R-E Ray Records, and then later further morphed into RER Records, which I think still exists. Really, really good label, naturally. And at one point in the 90s sometime, What Ray Records did was they had a quarterly, what would you call it, like a magazine. I mean, there were albums, and they decided to do quarterly releases of album, compilation albums. And they were great. Naturally, it went on for. I should have been prepared with this figure. I don't have it. It went on for a few years, let's say, and they did release these albums quarterly. So there was, you know, volume one, number one, volume one, number two, and so on and so on. All right, and naturally, great music on these things. They're still out there floating around. If you hunt for a copy, you should be able to find one, and. We're going to hear a track from volume one, number four of the Ray Records Quarterly. And again, we're going to hear this French group, Art Moulu Trefin. This was released in, I'm looking at it, 1986. Did I say 90s? Boy, was I wrong. I guess, you know, mid to late 80s is when the Quarterly series started. Anyway, Art Moulu Trefin from the Ray Records Quarterly, volume one, number four.
Thank you. We'll be right back.